Well, good morning, dear friends. So glad you're here this second day of March. Somehow it's March already. Sorry I wasn't able to be here in February, but I'm glad that we're here today. One of the gifts of these days of mindfulness, these days of practice, is not only do we get a little taste of being in the present moment, of being able to quiet some of the distractions that are around us all of the time, but we also get to do it together, which is really, really wonderful. And I know there are times when my mind is very agitated and distracted, and I come to a Sangha event and sitting next to a person who's very solid, very stable, and can really lean on that person for support. If I was home, it might be like, 10 minutes of sitting and then kind of, no, that's enough. Yeah, that feels fine. I got other stuff to do. But when you're with the Sangha, you want to help the community stay solid as well. And so even if I'm feeling a little agitated, the person next to me might be feeling solid, or the person next to that person, and we all kind of do this together. We support one another. It's a real gift, and we get to do this all day, which is another aspect of kind of having these longer periods of time to practice together. And I think I just wanted to note that the founder of Plum Village tradition, which this Sangha is a part of, the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh, he died 2 years ago in January. And this past month in February, there's been many ceremonies to honor his 2 year anniversary of his death. And one of the ceremonies that they held in Vietnam was to make Thich Nhat Hanh officially an ancestor. Before that, he was still the teacher of Plum Village, and now he has moved into that role of ancestor. He's joined a long, long line of ancestors that stretches back for 2,600 years. And all the way back to the Buddha, the founder of this particular expression of living. Really, that's what we're doing. And even in ancient India, the Buddha noticed that human beings have a tendency to be a little distracted now and again. He noticed that they have a lot of suffering. He noticed that they were disconnected from one another. He noticed that they were very afraid. People were fearful and grasping onto all sorts of things. And he himself did those things for many years, for many decades, about 30 years before he set out on the spiritual path. And as he engaged in the spiritual practices of the time, he found that you could go into meditation or days of mindfulness or whatever it was that he was doing, and he felt better. He felt better while he was meditating. He felt better when he was quiet with community. But then he left the meditation. He went back to the routine of his life, or he left the retreat center or whatever it was that he was doing. And he noticed that he still had some lingering suffering. It didn't go away. It just kind of went on pause while he was doing these other things. And so he set out on how to really, really touch into and let go of that suffering. And he began a practice of kind of denying his body its basic needs. So asceticism, not bathing and standing in uncomfortable postures for long periods of time and not eating as a way of trying to really experience this kind of bodily suffering and finding a way to release his kind of connection to it. But he almost died as a result of the asceticism. And that's where this practice of Buddhism comes from, is he decided that there had to be some other way. Not just kind of the escapism of meditation, and not this kind of asceticism. And so that's what he offered the world, was a way of kind of engaging in life in a way that we can be free of suffering. I think I was talking to someone yesterday, and I said, sometimes it can feel like the Buddhists are a little bit of pain mongers, because we talk about suffering so much. There's reason for the talking about suffering, but when we look at what the Buddha taught, what he presented, he said, yes, there is suffering. This is the first noble truth. And author Stephen Batchelor kind of combed through the sutras and said that maybe the noble truths, another way of talking about it is noble tasks, things to actually do. And so instead of just the truth that there is suffering, the task is we need to perceive that there is suffering. We actually need to see it. And then the second task is we need to perceive that there is a reason, there's a cause for the suffering. And if we stopped there, then I would agree that Buddhists kind of are pain mongers. But the third task, or the third truth, is that there's an end of suffering. That's something to really celebrate. He didn't say that there's just suffering, deal with it. he said there's an end. And the task, of course, is that you can perceive the end, or you can engage with the end of suffering. And the fourth truth, or the fourth task, is a path that the Buddha laid out so that we could end suffering. So it's actually really hopeful. It's a hopeful practice. But the first part of it is to really perceive that suffering. He didn't deny that there is pain in the world. He didn't deny that there's grief in the world and sadness. There were wars at the time of the Buddha. And he even tried to intervene in one and was unsuccessful. The war continued. He didn't deny that these things were there. He also didn't call those suffering. What he called suffering was attachment, grasping, clinging, pushing away, denying. All these things that are kind of activities of our, really our consciousness. And he saw that these things are really very, very deep inside of us. And really wanted to let people know that there is a way of releasing some of that suffering. He had touched into it, tapped into it. And then he spent the next kind of 45 years systematizing it and offering it to other people as a way of having that path. And ever since then, we've just continued to offer and explain and teach and show how to do it. And our ancestor, Thich Nhat Hanh, really focused on present moment, being in the present moment. And at first blush, this is kind of an easy practice. It's like, where else are you? And, but it has many, many layers to it, this practice of present moment. Present moment, really being in the present, because it asks of us to actually truly be in the present. It asks us of us a letting go, a letting go of our assumption that there's going to be a next moment, of letting go of our past, of letting go of who we think we are, our identity. That's a really big ask. And this practice of present moment, we can experience it immediately. If we just kind of take a breath and just notice where we are, we can kind of feel some of that that relief of grasping, of clinging, of pushing away, a relief of that suffering. It takes away quite a bit of our suffering just being in the present moment. But for me, and I think for probably all of us, there's a little hook in there. We don't quite let go into the present moment. There's a little kind of remainder or a little assumption that things are going to continue in the way that we want them to, things like that. The other day, just the other day, 2 days ago, I was practicing with this, with this idea of really letting go. It was a really powerful, powerful insight into how deep our roots of clinging to identity, clinging to this idea of ourselves go. I felt myself like in this kind of little box that I had made, that my culture had made, that my family and ancestors, my blood ancestors had made, that my kind of habits of perception had made, this little box. And it almost felt like, you know, if you just could jump out of that box fast enough, right around the corner, that's where the freedom is. That's where the freedom is. But it was just out of grasp. And what was surprising to me during that experience was just a strong sense of sadness emerged. That surprised me. I was shocked, actually. I was like, what is this coming from? And that sadness, I think, has very deep roots as well. I think that sadness could be suffering. I didn't spend too much time trying to analyze it because I don't think that's what it showed up for. I don't think it wanted to be parsed and figured out and named and quite honestly, I didn't really want to put the energy into doing that. It's not because I was being lazy, but it just felt like it would take me out of that experience if I started trying to analyze it too much. Kind of analysis is my safe space. Don't really like to not do that. And of course, the experience passed, as all experiences do. They come and go. But it was a really powerful, profound, I think, understanding of how deep these roots of attachment and clinging, how deeply they go. Actually made me a little excited, too, because it means that, oh, there's so much more to this present moment practice. There's more to learn and unpack and understand and experience. It was really nice. The Buddha talked about present moment practice, but one of the corollaries that you can attach to this present moment practice is what he talked much more about, which is non-self, not having a separate self. I know that when we talk about this practice, we talk a lot about kind of observing and being aware of all of the elements that come to make who we are. And we have the physical elements that we ingest through our food and drink that form our body. And so when you have a glass of water, and even before you drink it, that water is part of you, and you are part of that water. There's this connection. They're not separate. And there's practices to look kind of deeply into the body and to see that it's composed of elements outside of us that have come to us. There's similar practices you can do with your kind of emotional world, similar practices you can do with your contents of your mind, your thinking, and even your consciousness. And these practices start to provide us some relief from suffering when we start to engage with them, when we start to see that, yes, it's a truth, you know. The things that make up my body come from outside of me. That's, you hear that and it's like, okay, I get it. Next, right, next practice. And you may even have some enjoyment, some insight that comes about that, like a, kind of a letting go, a release of like, oh, that's really, really amazing. And then if you're like almost everybody else, you know, maybe a few seconds or minutes later, it all comes crashing back and you forget about it. And, you know, you go about your day as though that you're... So your body or your feelings or your mind are yours, that they are separate. And then you come to a day of mindfulness and you hear that they're not, and you're like, oh yeah, that's right, yeah, that's great. Then you leave and you forget, and or even while you're sitting here, you forget. I do all the time. I think we all do. But one of the things that that insight just the other day helped me understand is that And I'm not sure that I really ever truly trust that this body is not mine. I don't know if I ever really settle into non-self. And there's all those little hooks of clinging, of attachment, of assumption, of habit. You know, a little less kind of profound example that I can share is that when our first child was born, you know, and leading up to the birth, I kind of was like, okay, you know, this is going to be hard. It's going to be a big change. But, you know, it's like, I'll see what happens. And I'm ready for it, you know. Good practitioner, I can adapt and all these things. And then our child was born and it was different, right? It was okay, yeah, this is I was ready for this, I was prepared. And then a couple of weeks went by and I was like, ooh, this is still kind of different. And then, you know, a couple of months go by and it's like, whoa. This is still really different, and it's like I kind of braced myself for the change. And I prepared for the fact that things were changing. And then when I met the change, it was like, yeah, I was prepared for this. You know, I'd rolled my sleeves up and I was all ready. But what I hadn't really accounted for was that it was changed forever. Hadn't quite grasped that yet. And grasped in terms of understood it. Took quite a while to really settle into that. Oh, this is what it is now. And in some ways I wonder too if the preparation even got in my way. Because I was so certain that, you know, I was ready for whatever it was. You can insert your own experience here. If you've had a major illness or a major loss or any big transition in your life, kind of keep waiting for it to go back to the way it was. I think with my kid, my assumption was like, okay, it's going to be different, but it's going to be the same, except now I have a kid. I didn't really believe that it was going to be different. When we experience a profound loss in our life, you know, it's like, you know it's going to be hard, and you keep waiting for it to go back to the way it was. As we age, and our bodies change, we know that they're changing. We know it. But there's still this little hook of like, but it's just going to go back to the way it was. I think that's a little bit of what maybe that sadness was about. There's a sadness that it's not going to go back the way it was. And some things I'm glad that they're not going to go back the way they were. But that's just the other, that's just the same thing. And so this practice of non-self, that's kind of the physical, like the physical, mental, emotional space is the practice of non-self. And then the other practice that is just the flip side of that, but looks at kind of things throughout time is the practice of impermanence. They're really similar practices, just looking at different different aspects of our life through different lenses. There is a sadness. Perhaps it's grief, perhaps it's something else. When we let go of who we thought we were and who we think we are, and that's the first two truths. And when we really let go of those things, when we really practice non-self and impermanence, we get a something new. We get freedom. Freedom from kind of being in that little box that we made for ourselves. And this practice of present moment, of non-self, of impermanence, these practices they can be used in several different ways. One way that we can use them is just to get some temporary relief. But I don't know about you, but I've never really been able to talk myself out of grief or frustration or things like that. And I can't tell myself, oh yeah, if I just remember that, you know, I'm made up of all these non-self elements, right? This just starts to become kind of circling around. And so, so these practices, when I say they can provide temporary relief, they can remind us that, you know, maybe our experience is bigger than what we're experiencing in that moment. Maybe we can tap into kind of this larger experience. It can be a reminder. And we can have some fruit from just going through those mental exercises. We can touch into that, you know, our grief is shared by so many other people on the planet right now. Our joy is shared by so many other people right now. Our fear, our worry. And when we keep engaging with that practice, we can go really deep into kind of the core of our suffering, which is this, what the Buddha says is a mistaken belief that we are separate, a mistaken belief that we are unchanging. These kind of foundational practices that the Buddha offered were really antidotes to that, what he observed in his experience of the world, in his experience of being raised in a life of luxury as a prince, and then going through his spiritual exercises and component practices. His experience of really valuing the relief from meditation, but recognizing that that wasn't all there was. You may have noticed that Buddhism still has lots of meditation in it, so it's not that meditation in and of itself is a temporary relief. The way that we practice meditation in here, the way that we practice mindfulness in here, is first we kind of eliminate as much distraction as we can, even though we're across the street from an emergency room. And even though, you know, I just talked all about non-self, but we still do have bodies, right? We still get uncomfortable or have to go to the bathroom or those things. But we try to minimize the distractions. Many people even close their eyes so that they don't have the visual distraction. And we just really practice present moment, really letting go into whatever our experience is in the moment. We breathe in, we breathe out, we observe the body, noticing it. We observe our mind as it pulls us away from observing our body into kind of whatever's coming next or whatever happened before or whatever will be happening. But we just pull it back and we come back into this present moment, into this experience that we're having. And we practice letting go. We really do. We practice letting go of letting go of creating an experience for ourselves, but really trying to practice what is really happening right now in my mind, in my body, in my heart. And we don't stop there, though, because usually I've been realizing that suffering is very kind of noisy. Like, and what I mean by that is it really likes to get our attention. It's flashy, right? It's really wants us to know it's there. And so it rattles things around and shouts at us and says, look at me, look at me. And so at first kind of pass as we do this meditation, you notice all the suffering, the discomfort, the kind of agitation in the mind, all those things. But we don't stop there. This is why having a community practice is helpful, because at home, you might sit down and be like, this isn't great, I'm going to go do something else. But then we get the support of the people around us that are maybe having the same experience, but at least outwardly they're quiet. And so we kind of settle into like, okay, what else is going on here? What else is there? There's not just suffering. Then you start to notice, it's like, oh, you know, as my mind quiets, or sometimes the mind doesn't quiet, but as we just kind of let it do its own little noisy dance in the background, and we just kind of, it's like, thank you, I know you're there, I'm going to come over here. Just put my attention into my breathing. Well, that's, you start to get a little relief, a little letting go of some of that other suffering. We use the breath as a focus point because, you know, we started at 9, right? We started 9 o'clock this morning. You know, at 8:30, you were probably still breathing. And then you sit down and you notice the breath. And if you're new to the practice, if you've been doing it for decades, you start to notice it's like you kind of want to control it. Because the breath is one of these wonderful parts of our body that are both autonomous, but also that we have control over. And so we focus on the breath because it helps us experience letting go of needing to control our breathing, just letting it come as it was doing, you know, before we sat down and started looking at it. That is a really hard practice. I think as you engage in sitting practice more, meditation practice, you'll start to notice some of those hooks that we have, that little bit of control, a little bit of grasping. Maybe it's just me, but I don't think it is. Really just letting it come. Just letting our breath breathe. Don't have to, and that's as we heard in our guided meditation, you know, if it's short, it's short. We just notice that it's short. If it's long, it's long. We just notice that. And usually, as we engage in meditation, our breath will naturally become deeper and slower just because we're settling and just because we're relaxing. And when you relax, your breath just comes deeper and slower. But that's not the goal, so we don't have to do it. We don't have to make it happen. It's just something that happens as we notice it and as we relax. And so that practice of noticing the breath, being aware of it, is this practice of letting go. It's this practice of non-self. And it gives us a little bit of a taste of what it can be like to really let go of controlling our experience, of putting ourselves in that box. And so in Thich Nhat Hanh is teaching about present moment, wonderful moment. And he's teaching about being present, about mindfulness. He's teaching us about these other practices too, of non-self, impermanence, of letting go, of releasing. And there's different kind of layers to this. You don't have to let go of everything to start the practice of being in the present moment. In fact, that's where you start. You start by just being in the present, and then you keep being in the present, and you keep noticing these other things that go deeper and deeper and deeper. And but like I said, you don't have to experience total letting go, total experience of non-self, to enjoy some relief from suffering. I know just sitting quietly, I get immediate relief from suffering because you know, the contents of my mind are just a little more remote. And that's wonderful. That's something to celebrate. And if you can let go a little bit more, that's wonderful too. Something to celebrate. All of these things. We're really ending suffering by engaging in each of these practices. Another practice that Thay, which is a familiar name for Thich Nhat Hanh, for, means a teacher in Vietnamese. Another practice that he offered that comes from the Zen tradition, that Plum Village is part of a historical Zen, is he simply just says, "This is it." That's present moment practice. This is it. three little words. But really, that is a profound practice, something you can carry with you. The reason that it's so powerful when it's kind of rooted in this mindfulness and present moment practice is when we say this is it, it cuts right through to this grasping of how we might want things to be in the future, or this this kind of rehearsing of the past. And then usually what happens with sometimes with the past is that we keep wanting to get back to how things were in the past, which is looking at the future but having it be informed by the past. Or even in the present moment, you know, where you think this body is me, this is my body, this is it, cuts right through that, cuts through all of that, at least for a moment. Usually all the other stuff comes piling back on after. But you can see it really clearly when you engage in that practice. And I love that reminder that, well, I don't have to wait for things to be better. I don't have to wait to be a better practitioner. I don't have to regret things that I may have done in the past. So this is it, right now. And what better time to practice letting go than right now? And so as we sit with that practice of this is it, it's informed by all these other things that we were talking about this morning. And it helps, it's another antidote to that idea of clinging. There's a sutra that's recited frequently in Plum Village. The English translation is the Discourse on Knowing the Better Way to Live Alone. And in it, the Buddha offers some practices about the past, the future, and the present. And he talks about, you know, when we are being caught by the past. He says we look at our body in the past, our feelings, our perceptions, our mind, our mental formations, our consciousness. We look at them in the past. And we cling to it. We grab onto it. Like, this is how my body was in the past. You grab it and you want it. And he says, that's suffering. He said, so how do you not get caught by the past? Well, he doesn't say you don't ever look at your body in the past. He actually goes through the same list. He says, you look at your body, how it was in the past, your feelings, your perceptions, your mental formations, your consciousness. You look at those things. And he just says, and you're not caught by them. That's how you cannot be caught by the past. Sometimes when we're new to this practice, you know, we think like, well, if we're really in the present, you know, and like I have to leave the house to go somewhere, like, can I think about like the things I need to bring with me? Because then I'm thinking about the future and I'm not really in the present. But the Buddha says, no, you can absolutely think about how you were in the past. He does the same list for the future, how your body will be in the future, how it your mind, feelings, all those things, consciousness. Of course, you can think about those things. You can observe those things, the past and the present. But he warns us, don't grab onto it. Because this is it. Not that, not that. Not the past, not the future. This is it. Another way of saying that is, don't introduce suffering into your life for no reason. Because that's what we do when we cling to the past or the future. We just introduce suffering. One of my favorite little sayings from the AA community is that expectations are just premeditated resentment. I think that probably could have been in one of the sutras somewhere too. I don't know if it was that picky, but maybe when you say, when you observe all these things in the future, but you don't get caught by them, that's saying the same thing. Because it's true, when we want things to be different, when we expect them to be different, you know, we just introduce suffering. The other morning, I was getting the kids wanted to go skiing and snowboarding, and so I was getting ready to bring them. And I had woken up, and I took the dog for a walk, and folded laundry, and was starting to get like their lunches ready and things like this. And in my mind, and I'm starting to spiral. It's like, where are they? You know, they're just upstairs in their beds on their computer. Like, here I am doing all this stuff. And they're happily just doing, going about their lives. But I'm building this expectation. And it's like, yeah, they should have really, you know, said, like, Dad, do you need any help? Like, what do you want to do? And then, so this was going on in my mind for like an hour. Slow learner I am. But then my oldest kid came down, and he's like, hey, are we going to go skiing today? And how do you think I felt? I was like, oh, how wonderful. Yes, let's go, son. No, it was like, where were you? I've done all these things today, and you haven't helped at all. That was all me kind of setting up these expectations. I could have knocked on their door and said, hey, you know, if we're going to go, I could use some help. And even then, expecting them to be like, sure, I'll help. Because they're kids. But that's kind of imagining how things are going to be in the future. And then getting upset when they're not that way in the future. I spent a whole hour practicing, premeditated resentment. And that's easy to see. That's so easy to see. And we can see this pretty easily in our other relations. It's a little harder to see when we start getting in real close. Kind of to our own sense of identity of self. It's a little harder then. Because even though I know that my body is changing, I know that I'm going to die. I know that. There's a little part of me that doesn't quite believe it. That's that practice of non-self, of really letting go and believing it. Not just believing it, but experiencing it, trusting, really trusting the present moment. How different my engagement would have been getting ready for skiing if I could have just had a little taste of that. But how different my engagement with life is when I can really, really trust that experience. Not have that little hook of, yeah, I know it, but. One of the, if you're new to Buddhism, you'll find that Buddhists love lists, particularly numbered lists. I don't know if that was just maybe a predilection of the Buddha himself, but more than likely it's because it was an oral tradition for hundreds of years before it was written down, and so it was a way of, mnemonic, a way of remembering. That's why you have the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And one of the things I was going to mention is the five powers, or five ways of kind of giving some enthusiasm to our practice. And the first of those five powers is faith or trust. And so what are we trusting in? What is that faith in? Lots of answers to that. One of the things that we have trust in is that we can do it. That takes a lot of trust, a lot of faith. As the Buddha was dying, he reminded all of the people who had come to say goodbye to him, he reminded them that be your own lamp, be your own teacher. Trust yourself. It's one aspect of that power, is trust. Another aspect is to trust the teachings. And even if you don't have the experience of that deep practice of non-self, trust that that practice is there. And that, you know, as you move along this path, that it will deepen. Just have some, well, you probably wouldn't be here if you didn't think that these teachings worked. And so trusting that they do work, and that as you apply them, it will make more sense. The Buddha actually said to a group of villagers that said, why should we trust you? You know, we get all sorts of people who come by here and tell us, you know, they've got the way. And he says, don't trust me, actually. Trust that if you apply these teachings, if you apply these teachings, that you will have relief from suffering. If you don't have relief from suffering, don't do it. So he had trust in his path to be able to say that. But there is that trust in these teachings. And the other element of faith or trust is really trusting that this is it. Really trust, have faith that you can be right here, right now. And with various degrees of freedom of suffering. And you don't have to wait till tomorrow. You don't have to wait till the next sitting practice. You don't have to wait till the ambulance passes and it's quiet again. You don't have to wait. Because this is it. This is it. This moment. I know I said it before, but that was before. So this is it. The other powers all flow from that. You know, if you have that trust in yourself, in the teachings, in the present moment, you actually get some energy, some enthusiasm. That's the second power, is energy. So that your engagement with life feels kind of fresh. And as you get some energy, you get your skill of mindfulness deepens. Mindfulness just you know, being one part of the Eightfold Path, it's also one of these powers, but you have this mindfulness of being able to put your attention where you want it to go on purpose, not just running after whatever it grabs onto, whatever's noisiest, either internally or externally. And as your mindfulness deepens, your concentration deepens, and as your concentration deepens, you get wisdom or insight. You learn things. It's like, oh yeah. And when you learn things, you have a little more faith or trust in the practice, because it's like, yeah, that's, oh, I didn't know that before. And it just keeps going. So it's a continuous practice. Our dear friend, Dharma teacher in Missoula, Rowan Conrad, says one of the things that really inspires him is, even as Thich Nhat Hanh was aging, he said, you know, I love waking up in the morning because I get a fresh insight every day. And if he's getting insights every day, that gives me trust and faith that it's like, we can keep getting insights. Because he never said, I've arrived and I'm done. He kept practicing. And all of those, all of these practices that we do, and we've kind of gone into some deep waters here this morning, really looking at the root, the fundamental root of our suffering, this attachment to an idea of a separate self. But we don't want to just focus on those first two noble truths. We don't want to focus on just the idea that there's an end of suffering. Because that just kind of, it just feels like it's more suffering. It's like, oh yeah, someday suffering will end. but we really want to celebrate the times when our suffering's a little diminished, when we have some freedom from it. You know, when we feel happy, just taking that time to, this is great, you know, I feel happy right now. You don't have to go into all this, oh, but there's a little hook of non-self in this happiness. It doesn't matter. It'll be there. You know, just celebrate a little freedom from suffering. When, you know, you engage in the world, and there's so much suffering in the world, and I don't just mean pain, although there's a lot of that too. There's a lot of suffering kind of heaped on about ideology and who's right and wrong and all these things. And when you encounter some of those things and you're not completely pulled into despair, you actually feel solid that you can hold it. Celebrate that, because that's a gift for the world to be able to do that. You know, whatever situation you're in, you know, if my kids come down and I've worked all morning and they want to go skiing, and I say, yeah, let's go skiing. Celebrate that, because I know what it's like to not experience that. not feeling. So when we respond differently than we have in the past, that's transformation at work. And that should give us a little more faith and trust in the process. We don't want to always focus on the noisy suffering, which is like, oh yeah, but you didn't do it this time. It's like, yeah, but I did do it this time. That was great. Kind of as we engage in this practice, there's no end to it. I suppose if there was an end to it, the Buddha probably could have stopped teaching and, you know, humanity would have been all released from suffering. There's no end to it, which gives me actually hope instead of despair, that it just keeps going. And to really be gentle with ourselves, really tender with ourselves. Some of the things that I say to myself, I can't imagine saying to somebody else. And so just noticing that part of ourselves and being compassionate for that poor suffering part of ourself, and to be gentle with that part. And to remember our love and our compassion for ourselves, but for each other. Each other here and everywhere. We don't want to pick and choose who gets our compassion and love. And so the title of this day of mindfulness, I think, This Ancient Path Continues. So every time we take a step in mindfulness, we're continuing this ancient path. Every time we take a breath in mindfulness, every time we get distracted and come back, the path is continuing. I think the best Dharma talk is the one where we're sitting quietly, kind of doing our own thing and exploring kind of the depths of our being, of our possibility. And applying our own insight, our own wisdom, our own experience to whatever it is, because it's ultimately where it resides in each of us. So as we move through the rest of our day, we'll have more opportunities for engagement. And another continuation that we'll have this afternoon is the transmission of the mindfulness trainings, which were originally handed by the Buddha to some of the lay followers of the time. And the Plum Village versions are a little more elaborate than the original ones, but they're the same idea. That part continues. There have been just countless people throughout the years who have said, like, yeah, this is the way that I want to live, and I'm going to apply these practices into my life. But I do encourage us to celebrate the moments that we have in our life, to truly celebrate the moments in our life when we notice transformation, when we notice different ways of engaging, different ways of being, because that's that means that things are different. When you have insight, everything's kind of different. You're different from how you were. You might have some of the old habit energies come back. Have you ever seen a slow motion video of someone blowing out a candle? It's really cool. The candle, the flame jumps off of the wick, and for a moment it's just hanging in the air, and then it disappears. And when you have an insight, you kind of blow the habit energy off of the wick. It still burns for a little while, so you'll still feel it, but the it doesn't have the same fuel that it did before to continue. So it's just got to burn itself out, and then eventually it'll be gone. So as you're celebrating and noticing those points of transformation, just have that trust that those old habit energies, when they come back, instead of being discouraged, you can notice, like, I'm relating to this differently than I was before. Ah, it's burning itself out. That's great. And then we can just move on to the next insight, and the next one, and the next one, together. So, glad to be here with you all. Thank you.